You may recall then that in the classic words of previously on Histories of Journalism, we wrapped up last week with that particular image, both from a discussion point in the seminar and from the lecture itself, that notion of Macmillan, Prime Minister of Great Britain, in the company of the President of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, and the indication being that they would be looking to the future. And from there, we move on to this particular image, which is, if anything, arguably even more loaded and dynamic in terms of what we're seeing there. And it also serves as the basis of what I'm going to be talking to you about over the next 35 to 40 minutes or thereabouts. In other words, youth culture and moral panic. But a picture is worth a thousand words. Consider Times Magazine's world aspect there, in which we have World and Friend, and the Globe effectively being fed the joys of what? Anybody got any ideas to what that world might be sucking from? How do you know?
Just the sea and the red.
Just the sea and the red, and the iconography of the image. And it's all you need to know that that drink, which allegedly had genuine cocaine as its secret ingredient, which emerged originally as a treatment to cope with ladies who were suffering from hysteria, has now become this global brand. And this is, as I say, in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, the whole notion of the American way of life. It's actually written down there. The American way of life. A critical element to start beginning to appreciate where we're coming from when we start talking about British, American cultures, ideals, and so on. Now, Harold Macmillan presided over a new era of consumer affluence in Britain, and was quite fortunate. His line, "You've never had it so good," was very much to the fore, and he was Prime Minister from 1957 to 1963. It was probably the Profumo scandal, which was one of the reasons why he stepped aside and was voted out of office. The Profumo scandal, effectively, after the Foreign Secretary John Profumo was found to be having relationships with a call girl who was also Christine Keeler, connected with a Soviet spy at the time. So if you want to actually see a movie which outlines this perfectly, starring the late John Hurt, check out Scandal. I'm sure it's available on various platforms with great music by Dusty Springfield and the Pet Shop Boys. But Macmillan was also named Super Mac because, again, he was seen as this wonderful, successful Prime Minister. The Tory party was developing the whole range of things from that angle. And it's fair to say that prosperity was gradually beginning to emerge for the hard, downtrodden British people as well. As I mentioned last time, in America, prosperity had come sooner for those who were not part of the white and ethnic underclass, or the black and ethnic underclass. If you were white, you were fine. If you were part of the ethnic underclass, unlikely you would notice any major differences at all. But the other key thing about America in particular, and certainly this branding of images, I mean, the Golden Arches didn't really emerge until the 1950s with Ray Kroc and the whole McDonald's brand, and likewise there were other areas that were evolving, which become global brands known literally by just spotting the logo and the ident from that point of view. That also was responsible for developing the notion of the teenager. The teenager is a marketing joy and a marketing delight, because for the first time you have a situation where a whole new market is emerging to whom you can sell things and sell stuff to, etc. And the actual name teenager first appeared in the United States of America probably around about 1938-39. Before that, you were at school, you graduated, you went to work. There was no middle ground. Effectively, same thing in Britain. You'd leave school at 14, that was the mandatory age. And if you didn't go into higher education or further education, that was it. You'd move into an apprenticeship, job of work, or service, or some sort of line. So there was very much a sharp cut-off point between child and adult. None of this middle-range setup where suddenly you actually have money to spend, and so on. The birth rate in Britain increased somewhat after the war, hence the term baby boomers. But At the same time, although the birth rate had increased slightly, there wasn't necessarily a huge increase in sizes of families. And if anything, family sizes were fairly small among the middle classes, usually no more than two or three. The Victorian notion of having 8 or 9 or 10 children clearly had kind of gone the way of all sorts of other areas. So you had better health facilities, fewer children dying in childbirth, so obviously family sizes developing. And also, among the working classes, family sizes were also beginning to fall. Children in general were better fed, they were better educated, and were generally healthier and taller than their parents had been in their generation. As a result of that, they tended to reach puberty earlier. However, children are expensive to raise. I'm sure your own parents say, if I am. But particularly if they're going to survive childhood, etc., that's also one of the reasons why there are lots of incentives not to have large families. You know, if you've got to invest heavily in your child, or if you have two children, etc., think seriously about the commitment that's actually there. Working class children would still predominantly play in the streets, as you can see there. Middle class children would tend to play indoors, primarily because of worries about traffic. Again, road system coming into play here, so you don't want to play outdoors, you could get run over, or abducted, or all sorts of things from that point of view. Also, the sizes of houses were increasing. So if you've got sizes of houses, some of which are being built from scratch, also getting bigger, and family sizes smaller, doesn't take a huge leap in logic to say, actually, you've got space to play indoors and do your sort of stuff there without necessarily going outside. Now, this is clearly before the PlayStation generation, before the screen generation, although it does come into the notion of television being seen very much as an opportunity where children were taking that to just watch their favourite television programmes and so on, and there are lots of arguments and developments with respect to that as well. And television in itself was becoming increasingly common during the 1950s. We spoke last week about one of the key areas that really developed television, that was 1953 Coronation. That provided a spike in sales, but it was continuing to increase in terms of the numbers of people who were very keen to have this wonderful device take centre stage in their room. Arguably, even now, Samsung have carried out surveys which suggests that flat-screen TVs and so on, the large television set is still very much a centrepiece of particular home environments and so on. Children would also tend to receive expensive toys to play with. Maybe it's again a case of parents wanting to overcompensate or provide better systems and better toys over and above the kind of standard traditional hoops, footballs and various other bits and pieces. But even the less affluent working classes would make efforts to buy the new toys which would become available and which were crucially being advertised to children in comic books, on radios, and so on and so forth. Although, as I say, the radio advertising wasn't really a key point here because, as the more astute of you will confirm, commercial radio didn't start until the 1970s. But certainly cinema, comic books, commercial television from 1955 onwards, very much seen as a way of promoting messages, brands, everything from Scalextric, Lego, and so on and so forth. Toys tended to be gender stereotyped. Boys would be encouraged to buy train sets, to buy matchbox cars, and certainly to play with Airfix models of warplanes. In other words, anything which, as Dominic Sandbrook would refer to, was to deal with speed, battle, or indeed travel. Girls, on the other hand, would usually be provided with dolls, which would be increasingly based on the American Barbie doll format. Barbie actually appeared in 1959. I suppose still going strong these days with all sorts of other, degree Barbie, journalist Barbie, all sorts of other areas. But in addition to Barbie dolls, there were also skipping ropes, dressing up games, hula hoops, and tea sets. So again, you're looking at that kind of domesticity in areas coming through on that basis. And most children would actually receive pocket money, which they would spend on sweets, comics, and toys. They were the key things. Probably ask your grandparents, perhaps even your parents, to sort of acknowledge what the sort of key things were from that point of view. Comics and books for children sold well. Again, you've got a fairly literate group of children here, basically been taught how to read and write at schools. They want to consume things, they want to consume literature and so on. And those comics and books were generally as gender stereotyped as the toys were. Captain W.E. Johns came up with a character called Biggles, who was an intrepid wartime pilot, very much aimed at the boy market. Noel Stretfield was an author who was very successful with a series of ballet and drama school stories for girls. And a lot of the literature that was available for children in this time was very much the literature of the empire, you might well say. There were clear areas where deference to adults was seen as being to the fore. There was an avoidance of what was seen as the American comic book industry, which had really taken off in 1938 with Superman and then Batman and so on, and indeed was permeating gradually into British culture, but only insofar as American import comic books were used as ballast in ships and ended up in newsagents around the country. So people kind of could access American comic book scenarios, but they weren't quite as easy to get as the Beano, the Dandy, Eagle and so on. Indeed, Eagle, which you can see issue 43 there from the 2nd of February 1951, published every Friday for fourpence, was very much a reaction against the Americanization era. Captain Dan Dare, pilot of the future, with his faithful sidekick Digby, very much put into the star lead there. And Dan Dare has been re-emerged and repackaged several times over the last 5 decades, emerging in 2000 AD, emerging as a TV series, emerging as an audio drama, still kind of echoes that whole notion of Dan Dare. And in many ways, he's a pilot, a wartime pilot, operating in space. This notion of a dashing, heroic airman, which again opens up the whole notion of what it is to be masculine, critiques of masculinity, what's being seen in this area. Other aspects of the Eagle, possibly because it was established by a Church of England vicar, include tales about St. Paul, Christian values, and lots of stories about British soldiers taking on board the Hun, Germans, and so on. All very popular. For girls, slightly different, but nevertheless still equally gender stereotype, arguably racially stereotyped. If you get a chance to have a look at the kind of the dialogue that comes through here in terms of Malani, the native Indian, with her big silvery moon, it falls, and the sensible white girl who obviously is not going to fall too much for that side of things, foiled by the silent three, again from school friend there, Betty Rowlands, Jean Derwent, and Peggy West were the members of a secret society, the silent three. They were spending part of the summer holidays at Betty's home. So you've got kind of areas which many people would say take Enid Blyton's Secret Seven, Famous Five, and other sort of areas within that, and really start looking at ways of showing adventure stories from, obviously, the schoolgirl perspective and more. Bunty, which launched in 1958, dealt with school stories, which featured heroic women, historic figures, fantasy, and elements from that point of view. Other girls, or older girls, would tend to go for the more mature makeup thing. Sadly, without any makeup, referring to highlighters and pens, because they hadn't emerged as yet. If you'd been here earlier, you would have got the reference to that. But anyway, in terms of the sort of areas, these were the things which basically for that teenage market were becoming more popular. Mirabelle, again, signed portrait of Rick Nelson. Oh, he could almost be a member of One Direction or not. Jackie, etc. This is slightly later, but again, looking at things like romantic journeys, glamour, those sort of issues coming through there, and song words to Down the Line and so on. All of these magazines and comics would include information about pop stars, about film stars, stacks of advertisements for clothing and cosmetics, and actually served the purpose of being consumer guides. Now, education in the 1950s was one which very much emphasised class. So did the reading materials. you know, there was quite clear elements of what was deemed to be upper class, lower class, and areas within that whole field, as was often the case. And there we have a class of 1953. Anybody spot anybody there? One of these days somebody's going to say, look, it's my gran, or whatever. But anyway, from that point of view, we have a situation whereby there's a two-tier system in education. Those who pass the 11 plus exam would go to grammar school, and most people who passed the 11 plus exam and went to grammar school were from the middle classes. The other 80%, because there was usually only 20% or a fifth of people who actually passed the 11 plus, the other 80% would go to secondary modern schools where they would be perceived as being academic failures. There's a lot of debate even now about, should we bring the 11 plus back? Some people have taken it away. Is it a selection process? Is it wrong to have a selection process at this stage? Should we have a selection process even earlier? Lots of debates which had never gone away and really emerged from this period in the 1950s. Some authors would see books by Enid Blyton as working class and common, and basically to be put to the same side as Spam, Fish Fingers, and comics. And vast numbers of children would leave school at age 14 or indeed 15. Again, because they simply head into apprenticeships or works, etc. Grammar school pupils, on the other hand, tended to stay on until they were 17 and often went into higher education as well. It's also fair to say that grammar schools had the best teachers, they had the best resources, and although some working class children did actually pass the 11 plus, they often found that because they were having to work in an area which had a completely different experience, socio and economic experience than what they'd been used to, it was very difficult to adapt to an environment where actually what you would do when you went home of an evening was to read a book as opposed to watch television. You certainly wouldn't watch ITV, you wouldn't watch a commercial station, you'd watch a BBC station, because that's the... And there's only a choice between the two. You've got the BBC or ITV. BBC Two doesn't actually start transmission until 1964, and then follows through 1967. So there's not a huge amount of choice there. You've got either the commercial station or the non-commercial station. And obviously, if you didn't want to be perceived as common, you would not actually refer to the commercial station. Of course you did, and of course people did watch ITV. And because the independent television had a lot of American imports, it was very popular, and you also had a number of shows which were developed exactly to target a populist audience, from game shows, from a variety of other things as well, that all had their roots in America, and so on. All of this tended to sort of lead to certain attitudes. Attitudes to work and attitudes to lifestyle. Higher education in betwixt times was continuing to expand throughout this period of the 1950s to 1960s and so on. So why was this? Well, the government had realised, both Labour and Conservative, that education, at its heart, is a good thing. It's one of the reasons we use this term education, educare, to lead out and develop skills that exist in everyone in this room. And it's just a case of tapping into that and providing the opportunity to develop those kind of areas. However, the government had hoped that an expansion of higher education would increase the numbers of scientists and engineers who would be graduating, which would in turn make Britain a much more competitive nation. And in fact, students in general preferred the arts and the social sciences by about 100 to 1. So for every one student who was doing a science technology subject, 100 would be doing an arts-based subject, either a social science or something along those bases. And Britain actually had more art colleges per head of population than anywhere else in the world. And we'll come back to the significance of that, and also had a massive impact in developing the success of the pop music industry later on in the session and in the module. Art colleges tended to attract those students who weren't very academic, but also the working and middle classes who were vaguely creative. So they didn't want to do maths, they didn't want to do the sciences, but they did want to do something where they could actually do some stuff, etc., something in the arts theme, etc. And entrance qualifications were generally low. Now, this all began in the words of the press and the media at the time to fuel this whole notion of the teenage image. Because if we look to the example in America, it's in the art schools that a culture called beatnik culture was starting to develop. Rhythm and blues, jazz, musical styles, students who would actually form pop bands would actually all emerge from this art cultural based thing. And a range of designers, artists, and a lot of the 60s artists that we come to know as pretty much influential began to emerge from this particular period. Okay, so that's a bit of background in terms of the school and the various other areas. What about people who basically didn't want to go to art college, didn't really want to actually go to an apprenticeship, didn't really want to go to higher education, etc., and in the large middle ground wanted to do something or would be forced to do something, which would be national service? Yep. If you didn't actually want to go to do any of the aforementioned jobs or opportunities or weren't heading off to higher education, it was mandatory that you would have to do up to 2 years, and possibly longer, in service for the country. So you'd be off to the army or one of the armed services and so on. National service actually continued for males pretty much until the early 1960s. It certainly was present throughout the 1950s. Number of reasons why. There was no guarantee that we weren't going to go straight into another world war. So rather actually sort of have to stop conscription and then start conscription all over again. Just keep it going. Secondly, it's seen as a good way of actually training people for a variety of jobs when they left national service. You may well have grandparents or competitors who say, that's what we need, bring back national service and so on. But it was seen very much as a line from that whole era. If you were 18-year-old and male, you had to undertake at least 18 months of national service, and actually during the Korean War, you had to do at least 2 years of national service, during which time you could be sent to a wartime environment, or you could be sent all over the place. As I say, it continued until 1960, with the last conscripts finishing their service, their national service in 1963. This, if you recall from last week, was also to support the presence of Britain in certain countries around the world. British troops were still spread thinly across the colonies, and the Soviet Union threat was considered extremely real. So we needed boots on the ground, quite literally, to actually be mobilised and work from that point of view. But in addition to that, national service as a concept also seemed a good thing in its own right. It was a way of promoting unity, it was a way of promoting patriotism. It was certainly a way of encouraging discipline and team play among young adults. Some enjoyed it, some didn't. And the experience that people actually had during national service was very diverse. Some never left the country, others saw action, others enjoyed the comradeship and matured, and others were just frightened. They found the whole thing just too overwhelming. Again, there's no kind of general sort of easy way out on this particular aspect. The thing was there, you either did it or not, as the case may be. However, it's interesting that when we move on to the rise of teenage culture, many critics would actually blame the ending of national service for some of the worst effects. Certainly in the 50s and 60s, teenagers, exhibit A, teenagers, they look like 80 years. Anyway, in terms of what we're seeing there, teenagers started to become much more prominent in the media. Because teenagers were more affluent, because if you'd left school at 14 or 15 and actually taken up work, even before national service, you had money in your pocket to actually spend. You didn't have to worry about responsibilities like owning a house or a home, probably not even a car, but you did have disposable income. And as I've mentioned, a network of manufacturers, retailers and publishers would develop which were aimed specifically at the teenage market. Now, it's fair to say that teenagers were not particularly influential. There was a notion in some critical eyes that they somehow changed the world. Well, not in any real sense, because most of society at any one time were not seen as teenagers or young people. The kind of ruling parties, people like Macmillan, people like Anthony Eden, people like Churchill, were people very much in their 50s and 60s and beyond. Big gulf in that particular time. And teenagers also, as you can guarantee from your own experience, we're not a coherent group. It's not one size fits all. You have a mixture of teenagers who are at school, people who are students, people who are young earners, and the teenagers themselves were divided by class, by region, by outlook, by age, by taste. Somebody in Newcastle may or may not like the same sort of things that are being liked by a teenager in Southampton. Who knows? However, what they did do was purchase stuff. And generally, they would buy things like bicycles and motorbikes, cosmetics, records, record players, and so on. Products were generally chosen which were emotionally charged products, which effectively they might have seen advertised on TV or in the cinema. Smoking was very cool. It's great to actually have your cigarettes and lines from that perspective. You'd also have basically American goods, very much prized as being a wonderful way of engaging with that glamour that was being seen in both the TV series and the movies and so on. Now, lots of critics at the time were quite shocked to find American consumer values, which from their point of view were sucking in the young generation. What was happening to our British youth when they were being so heavily influenced by the Americans? But nevertheless, there was still plenty of work available for the young. That work was relatively well paid, and those who were still living at home could splash out in a way which was totally different from their previous generations. Class certainly did affect and impact on how the young behaved. There were millions of fairly invisible teenagers, and those don't need to be confused with the notion of the smaller groups that were prominent in the press, the groups I'm going to go on to consider now in terms of teenagers who would develop and cause moral panic. Generally, though, it was seen as the working class and the lower middle class who would begin work at an early age. If you were upper middle class, so the upper class, you'd kind of be looking to guide into higher education and so on. You're less likely to be a rebel, less likely to challenge the status quo and so on. But at the same time, if you're lower working class, you would tend to have fairly tedious jobs, factory jobs. We'll see in a couple of weeks' time when we start looking at the angry young men and the notions of look back in anger and other sort of areas. There's a lot of potential irritation about society and various other things within that. In other words, teenagers are a diverse group with diverse tastes. And again, we're talking here primarily about the white teenage experience, as we'll see when we start talking about the immigration and the migrant population, that also changed and impacts as well from that point of view. So what have we got so far? Well, in the 1950s, broadly speaking, teenage culture is seen as predominantly working class. Dance halls, jukeboxes, motorbikes, pop singers, all occupations, activities that are mostly associated with young working class men and women. However, as early as the late 1940s, the Daily Mail, ta-da, is describing teenagers as hoodlums. They're describing teenage girls as brazen consumers of trashy films and fashions. F.R. Leavis is writing a text which bemoans the loss of culture in terms of our educational academic canon. He coins the term high and low culture in what's appropriate, what should be being studied, and what is inappropriate and is basically just trash culture and so on. And from the 1950s onwards, youth, with a capital Y-O-U-T-H, becomes a big issue. And the media starts launching a series of moral panics which relates to youth delinquency, to violence, to social deviance, mostly aimed at the working classes. Question. I know you're going to put this straight to the thing. What do we mean by moral panic? Answer. There. That's moral panic in six wonderful bullet points. You can apply it to most journalism and mass media forms, and it still tends to be used even today when you substitute things like migrant workers or football hooligans or, again, name your particular sort of aspect within that. How does it actually operate? Well, effectively, moral panic is something in which usually journalists or writers make use of what they perceive as being the general public's prejudices, and fears. In particular, they use the term moral majority. So we're looking at how people actually perceive from, we wouldn't do that, possibly. Isn't this shocking, this dreadful thing that's actually occurring? Most of the type of stories that we actually see within this particular field often can be characterised as creating moral panic, quite simply because they're overblown and because they're exaggerated. So you identify something which perhaps might be problematic, hoodies for instance, or indeed Leeds United supporters. And then you have a clear division between them, we're perfectly sensible football fans, we're not anything to do with those Leeds United folk, and you build around a them and us mentality. You then start enhancing a consensus. You get a notion that actually, yeah, you're right, you know. You know, yet again, this person actually addressed this, you know, those teddy boys, they've caused problems from that point of view. There's an agreement generally that there's some kind of threat that is then exaggerated with the demand that something has to be done. Get your finger out, Mr. McMillan. Sort it out. Let us know what's happening. And usually you find that that panic becomes short-lived. Now, the roots of this go back to Victorian times and go back to a gentleman called W.T. Stead, S-T-E-A-D, who actually used to base the entire line of the London Pall Mall Gazette on a series of moral panics, which reached its height with Jack the Ripper and a variety of other things, and on the basis that obviously it was all the foreigners who were invading London who effectively were responsible for the garrottings, the killings, the knifings, and so on and so forth. And usually after the demand that something is done, there's a kind of sort of response, can be knee-jerk response, and people say, okay, we'll move on to the next one. But that's broadly speaking, if you wanted to actually apply the whole system, that's how you generate that particular moral panic. That's not a recommendation. I'd certainly say you need to identify it without following that package. And there, lo and behold, the first major target of youth culture creating a scary, scary image of all sorts of aggressiveness and so on. Now, the ideas of problems with youth go back to the 19th century, as I mentioned. Young people can be seen as noisy, promiscuous, inexperienced, self-centred, and if you add to that the fact that in the 1950s the young had more money and were sometimes rather more visible, you've got all the ingredients to raise the whole sort of temperature just a wee bit further, especially when you have the teddy boys. And these were the initial folk devils of the 1950s. Now, teddy boys had basically a system in which they would have long, greasy hair worn in a quiff. They'd wear colourful shirts. They'd wear suits that primarily had almost a throwback retro time to Edwardian times at the start of the 20th century. But they also basically were developing this American aspect. The American tie that you got there, the sort of Western American Maverick, a very popular TV series at the time, which dealt with the Wild West and so on, and the gambler within that whole side of things. Primarily, teddy boys emerged from South London. It was a working class fashion that evolved from South London. The clothing was very expensive, and that, in a period of austerity, was something that was guaranteed to cause offence. Look at us, loads of money, look at the quality of this particular lining and so on. So it looked selfish. It also became a look that was quickly associated with violence and gang fights. Again, nothing particularly new. Young working class youths had been drinking, tooling up with bike chains and knives and fighting for generations. But when the media put a spotlight on it and start beginning to demonstrate how, oh look, this is permeating even as far north as Lincolnshire, although I'm never quite sure what this young man in the middle is. I think he always thinks he's a wannabe, as opposed to, I don't think she can care at all in terms of what things are. But in terms of the biker culture, made glamorous by Marlon Brando, James Dean, Rebel Without a Cause, the whole notion of the biker culture and so on, there's a line that suggests that there are challenges within that. It's interesting that the teddy boys were mostly associated with rock and roll. However, the teddy boy fashion had pretty much died out by the time rock and roll, including Bill Haley and the Comets and Elvis Presley and Chuck Berry, had arrived in Britain. And certainly by the time Elvis Presley got his first number one, teddy boys had kind of vanished from the system. Now, there's certainly no doubt if you look at the figures and statistics that juvenile crime and violence did tend to rise in the 1950s and beyond. From 1955 to 1961, the number of teenage boys who were convicted of serious offences doubled. And again, it's a sensitive subject in terms of where you're going through from that perspective, because as we'll see, there's also issues relating to race and immigration and things that come through in that as well. However, the vast majority, emphasised, vast majority of teenagers were not as violent or as rebellious as newspapers and indeed some historians have actually suggested. Teenagers tended not to get involved in politics. They weren't really bothered who was in power, and they weren't really that idealistic. Many students were actually quietly conservative and actually quite anti-American, because they'd recognised that actually they didn't want to necessarily just take in everything from what was being said over in America, etc. In other words, they simply weren't very radical. And even during the most frenzied bouts of moral panic that which you see in 1956 and 1964, most teenagers were simply not involved. They didn't want to kill anybody, they didn't want to save the world, they just wanted to spend money and be quite happy with their own particular lot in life. So what actually raised this youth panic, this moral culture? Well, it was mostly the media and the police that turned the youth into folk devils. According to Stanley Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, author of a book called Devils, Folk Devils and Moral Panics, teenagers in the 1950s and 60s could be united by fashion and music, and they formed subcultures like the Teddy Boys, like the Mods, like the Rockers. They would often reject the values of mainstream society, like the hippie movement, but at the same time, it was a case of they were expressing themselves and so on. Dominic Sandbrook argued that mainstream values were never that clear. There was more a creation of the media that was at work here. Something that people could react against. And most teenagers, by and large, conformed to what they saw as societal norms. Teenage crime was on the increase, yes, but teenagers were not necessarily the forefront of that. Teenagers were more sexually mature, yes, but that doesn't necessarily explain the media panic. And then in 1964, of course, some fighting broke out among the Mods and the Rockers at various seaside resorts over a bank holiday, May 1964. This took place most notably at Clacton and Brighton. This was how the BBC reported. I'm just quoting directly from the BBC statement at the time. Mods and Rockers jailed after seaside riots. Scores of youths have been given prison sentences following a Whitsun weekend of violent clashes between gangs of Mods and Rockers at a number of resorts on the south coast of England. Yesterday, two youths were taken to hospital with knife wounds and 51 were arrested in Margate after hundreds of teenagers converged on the town for the holiday weekend. Dr. George Simpson, chairman of Margate Magistrates, jailed four young men and imposed fines totalling £1,900 on 36 people. Three offenders were jailed for 3 months each, and five more were sent to detention centres for up to 6 months. In Brighton, two youths were jailed for 3 months, and others were fined. More than 1,000 teenagers were involved in skirmishes on the beach and promenade. They threw deck chairs around. Oh no! They broke those deck chairs. They broke them up to make bonfires, shouted obscenities at each other and at passers-by, jostled holidaymakers, and terrified elderly residents. In Margate, there were running battles between police and up to 400 youths on the beach. Early yesterday morning, bottles were thrown and two officers were slightly hurt. Later on in the high street, around 40 young men smashed council flat windows and vandalised a pub and a hardware shop. Okay, not great, not wonderful, but hardly something which is going to tip the nation into open civil war. You've got, when you look at the facts, maximum maybe a couple of thousand youngsters with nothing to do who turn up, converge together on the seaside, together with many thousands of ordinary families, which again was massively over-exaggerated, not just by the broadcast media, but by the press as well. Look at the Evening Argus. Battle of Brighton, 50 arrested. Mods let fly at the Rockers in fierce seafront clashes. Two stabbed in Margate flare-up. 17 more die on roads. Special offer, the Elite Electric Sink, etc. Yeah, it's the classic way of raising the temperature and flagging up what is causing a problematic issue. The Birmingham Post editorial in May 1964 warns that Mods and Rockers were internal enemies in the United Kingdom who would bring about disintegration of a nation's character. again, draw the parallel between the step-by-step line I was talking about with respect to moral panic, and you get a kind of general sense of what we're seeing here. The magazine Police Review argued that the mods and rockers' lack of respect for law and order could cause violence to surge and flame like a forest fire. The Daily Mirror, Wild Ones, referencing the Marlon Brando movie, The Wild Ones, invade Seaside. 97 arrests. The Wild Ones invaded a seaside town yesterday. 1,000 fighting, drinking, roaring, rampaging teenagers on scooters and motorcycles. By last night, after a day of riots and battles with police, 97 of them had been arrested. A desperate SOS was sent out from police at Clacton, Essex, as leather-jacketed youths and girls attacked people on the streets, turning over parked cars, broke into beach huts, smashed windows, and fought with rival gangs. It was quite like a sort of Sunday joint saved by wives. Thank heavens there's some sort of normality that's there. It's not a drug reference, by the way. But again, you see the way in which, obviously, selling papers, working through the process, raising the profile. This is hardly, I mean, if this is the best shot they can actually get, I think Stuart Wilde would be a bit embarrassed about that. Really? Seriously? You know, one police dog and, you know, youths in leather jackets help a police officer making inquiries last night into the rampage by gangs of teenagers at the seaside town of Clacton. A police dog stands by. Brian Wilson argued that the supposed teenage problem related to problems in the wider society. This is the supposed teenage problem. Society was inevitably changing. We're seeing this shift. Britain has gone through a period of austerity. More and more people are having funds to use, disposable income, etc. And there is a fear, an understandable generational fear, that folk do not like change. And they see a situation whereby we're having a slightly longer period of peace. Remember the difference, the time between the end of World War I, 1918, and the start of World War II, 1939, 21 years. So there is that sense that, well, are we going to sort of head down to complete cataclysm at the same time? And in 1964, obviously, we'd also had the assassination of American President John F. Kennedy. We'd also had the Cuban Missile Crisis. We were beginning to get the Vietnam War. So there were concerns, but did they warrant and merit the kind of panic that we were seeing demonstrated in this particular aspect? Teenagers, however, were visibly seen as a symbol of the changes and also the insecurities of that period from 1955 throughout actually the 1960s. And we see again in the 1970s with the punk movement that also impacts solidly in terms of the fear and the concern that people have and so on. In many ways, these newly affluent teenagers didn't necessarily have the education or the information that was necessary in order to cultivate their own particular tastes and their own particular activities. It was quite clear that they were being commercially exploited. They were the victims at best of ephemeral and not very satisfying fads. And also, pre-social media, to depress them from a psychological point of view, they were also bored. You know, okay, you go to the cinema, you watch TV, you go to the cinema, you might do voice, but what are you going to do? How are you going to sort of, where are you going to get your kicks, etc.? Now again, collectively, we also see the beginnings of a decline of traditional authority. The notion of actually having respect for the police force, respect for the agencies of society, and so on. There was a gradual instability within family relationships. The notion of the nuclear family, mum, dad, 2.4 children, not necessarily seen as the ideal. And yet, that's the ideal that's being presented. There was very much the beginnings of the breakdown of the class system. Materialistic attitudes were very much there. And there was also this suspicion of American values and a suspicion of American products, which also, although they became associated with teenagers, they actually affected everyone. Teenage culture wasn't just challenging the mainstream, it was also a sideshow in a period of fairly immense social change. And again, as we're heading through that process, do you see the image of somebody who's just had a heck of a night on the town, or somebody who's actually drug-affected, impacted? And more to the point, here we have two women, females, wearing trousers. OMG, it's the end of society. Okay, we will talk more about that on Thursday. Thank you for your time. Make sure you've signed the register. And please do not engage in any violence in Lincoln between then and now, even if you don't like these United people.